Book 4. The Path Forever Walked. When your penance is done, come find me. When all the judges cloaked in stone have faced away, seek the rill beneath the bowers and strings of fine pearls down in the fold of sacred hills, among the elms where animals and birds find shelter. Come find me. I am nestled in grasses never trod by heartbroken knights and brothers of kings. Not a single root torn in the bard's trembling grief. Seek out what is freely given. Come find me in the wake of winter's dark flight and take what you will of these blossoms. My colours lie in wait for you and none other. Come find me, Fisher. Chapter 19. In the midst of fleeing the unseen enemy, I heard the hollow horrors of the wretched court. We collected our gasps to make ourselves a song. Let the last steps be a dance. Before the spears strike and the swords slash, we'll run with torches and right the night with glutted indulgences, our precious garlands bold laughter to drown the slaughter in the stables of the lame and poor. Entwine hands and pitch skyward. None will hear the dread groans of the suffering, nor brush with tips glistening sorrowed cheeks on stilled faces below. Let us flee in mad joy. The unseen enemy draws near, behind and ahead, and none will muster to this harbinger. Call for as long as we are able to run these perfect circles. Confound the fates, all you clever killers. I am with you. Unseen Enemy, Efflit Tarn. Moving like one bludgeoned, Kilmandaros slowly, by degrees, picked herself up from the ground. She leaned to one side and spat red phlegm, and then glanced over to see Erastus lying curled on the dead grasses, motionless as a stillborn calf. Off to one side stood Setchul Lath, arms wrapped tightly about his torso, face bleached of all warmth. She spat again.
It's him.
A summoning beyond all expectation, Setchul said. Odd, Erastus looks less than pleased at his own efficacy.
Kilmandaros levered herself upright, stood unsteadily.
He could be subtle when he wanted, she said in some irritation. Instead, he made sure to let us know.
Not just us, Setchul replied. Nothing so crass, he added, as careless.
Is it anger, do you think?
He rubbed at his face with both hands.
The last time Draconis was wakened to anger, mother, nothing survived intact. Nothing.
He hesitated and then shook his head.
Not anger, not yet, anyway. He just wanted everyone to know. He wanted to send us all spinning.
Kilmandaros grunted.
Rude bastard.
They stood at the end of a long row of standing stones that had taken them round a broad, sweeping cursus. The avenue opened out in front of them, with scores of lesser stones spiralling the path inward to a flat-topped altar, its surface stained black. Little of this remained in the real world, of course. A few toppled menhirs, rumpled tussocks and ruts made by wandering Bedouin. Erastus had drawn them ever closer to a place where time itself dissolved into confusion. Assailed by chaos, straining beneath the threats of oblivion, even the ground underfoot felt porous, at risk of crumbling under their weight. The builders of this holy shrine were long gone. Resonance remained, however, tingling her skin, but it was an itch she could not scratch away. The sensation further fouled her mood. Glaring down at Erastus, she asked,
Will he recover, or will we have to drag him behind us by one foot?
A satisfying image, Setchul conceded. But he's already coming round. After the shock, the mind races.
He walked up to where the errant lay.
Enough, Erastus, on your feet. We have a task to complete, and now more than ever it needs doing.
She took an eye, rasped the figure lying on the grasses. With it, I would have seen.
Only what you wanted to see, Satrul finished. Never mind that now. There is no going back. We won't know what Draconis intends until he shows us, or, abyss forbid, he finds us. He shrugged. He's thrown his gauntlet down. Erastus snorted.
Gauntlet? That Setch was his fist.
So punch back, Satrul snapped. Kilmandaros laughed.
I've taught him well, haven't I?
The errant uncurled and then sat up. He stared bleakly at the altar stone.
We cannot just ignore him, or what his arrival tells us. He is freed. The sword Dragnipur is shattered. There was no other way out. If the sword is shattered, then Rake is dead, said Kilmandaros.
Silence for a time. She could see in the faces of the two men sweeping cascades of emotion as they contemplated the raw fact of Anamanda Rake's death. Disbelief, denial, wonder, satisfaction, and pleasure, and then fear.
Yes, she said. Great changes, terrible changes. But, Erastus looked up at her, how was it possible? Who could have done such a thing? Has Osirk returned? No, we would have sensed that.
He climbed to his feet.
Something has gone wrong. I can feel it.
Satrul faced him.
Master of the Holds, show us your mastery. You need to look to your own hands and the power within them.
Listen to my son, said Kilmandaros. Seek the truth in the Holds, Erastus. We must know where things stand. Who struck him down? Why? And how did the sword break?
There is irony in this, Satrul said with a wry smile. The removal of Anamanda Rake is like kicking down a gate. In an instant, the path beyond runs straight and clear, only to have Draconis step into the breach. As deadly as Rake ever was, but a whole lot crueler, that much closer to chaos. His appearance is, I think, a harbinger of the madness to come. Squint that lone eye, Erastus, and tell me you see other than ruination ahead.
But the errant was shaking his head.
I can tell you now who broke Dragnipur. There could be no other. The warlord.
Breath hissed from Kilmandaros.
Brood. Yes, I see that. The weapon he holds, none other. But that only confuses things all the more. Rake would not have willingly surrendered that weapon, not even to Caladan Brood.
She eyed the others.
We are agreed that the Son of Darkness is dead, yet his slayer did not take Dragnipur. Can it be that the warlord killed him?
Satrul Lath snorted.
Centuries of speculation. Who was the deadlier of the two? Have we our answer? This is absurd. Can any of us even imagine a cause that would so divide those two with the history they shared?
Perhaps the cause was Dragnipur itself.
Kilmandaros grunted.
Think clearly, Erastus. Brood had to know that shattering the sword would free Draconis and 1,000 other ascendants.
Her hands closed into fists.
And Elaint. He would not have done it if he'd had a choice. Nothing could have so fractured that ancient alliance, for it was more than an alliance. It was friendship.
She sighed heavily and looked away.
We clashed, yes, but even me. No, I would not have murdered Anamanda Rake if the possibility was presented to me. I would not. His existence had purpose. He was one you could rely upon when justice needed a blade's certain edge.
She passed a hand over her eyes.
The world has lost some of its color, I think.
Wrong, said Satrul. Draconis has returned. But listen to us. We swirl round and round this dread pit of truth. Erastus, will you stand there frozen as a hare? Think you not the master of the deck is bleeding from the ears right now? Strike quickly, friend. He will be in no condition to intercept you. Indeed, make him fear we planned this, all of it. Make him believe we have fashioned the consort's escape from Dragnipur.
Kilmandaros' eyes were wide on her son.
Erastus slowly nodded. A detour of sorts. Fortunately, a modest one. Attend me.
I shall remain here,
announced Kilmandaros. At the surprise and suspicion she saw in the errant's face, she raised her fists.
There was the danger so close to the Elaint that I lose control. Surely,
she added, you did not intend me to join you when you walked through that last gate.
No, leave me here. Return when it's done.
Erastus looked round at the shrine's standing stones.
I would not think this place suited you, Kilmandaros.
The fabric is thin. My presence weakens it more. This pleases me.
Why such hatred for humans, Kilmandaros?
Her brows rose.
Erastus, really? Who among all the races is quickest to claim the right to judgment? Over everyone and everything. Who holds that such right belongs to them and them alone? A woodcutter walks deep into the forest, where he is attacked and eaten by a striped cat. What do his fellows say? They say the cat is evil and must be punished. The cat must answer for its crime, and it and all its kind must answer to our hate. Before too long, there are no cats left in that forest, and humans consider that just, righteous. Could I, Erastus, I would gather all the humans of the world, and I would gift them with my justice, and that justice is here, in these two fists.
Erastus reached up to probe his eye socket, and he managed a faint smile.
Well answered, Kilmandaros.
He turned to Setrul Lath.
Arm yourself, friend. The holds have grown feral.
Which one will you seek first?
The one under a jaghut stone, of course.
She watched as blurry darkness swallowed them. With the errant's departure, the ephemeral fragility of the ancient shrine slowly dissolved, revealing the stolid ruins of its abandonment. A slew of toppled, shattered stones, pecked facings hacked and chipped, the images obliterated. She walked closer to the altar stone. It had been deliberately chiselled, cut in two. Harsh breaths and sweat-slick muscles, a serious determination to despoil this place. She knew all about desecration. It was her hobby, after all, an obsessive lure that tugged her again and again, with all the senseless power of a lodestone. A few thousand years ago, people had gathered to build their shrine. Someone had achieved the glorious rank of tyrant, able to threaten life and soul, and so was able to compel hundreds to his or her bidding. To quarry enormous stones, drag them to this place, tilt them upright like so many damned penises. And who among those followers truly believed that tyrant's calling? Voice of the gods in the sky, the groaning bitches in the earth, the horses of the heavens racing the seasons, the mythologies of identity, all those conceits, all those delusions. People of ancient times were no more fools than those of the present, and ignorance was never a comfortable state of being. So they had built this temple, work gangs of clear-eyed cynics sacrificing their labor to the glory of the gods, but it wasn't gods basking in that glory, it was the damned tyrant who needed to show off his power to coerce, who sought to symbolize his power for all eternity. Kilmandaros could comprehend the collective rage that had destroyed this place. Every tyrant reaches the same cliff edge, aged into infirmity, or eyeing the strutting of heirs and recognizing the hungry looks in their regard. That edge was death, and with it all glory fell to dust. Even stone cannot withstand the fury of mortals when fueled by abnegation. Nature was indifferent to temples, to sacred sites. It did not withhold its gnawing winds and dissolute rains. It devoured such places with the same remorseless will that annihilated palaces and city walls, squalid huts and vast aqueducts. But carve a face into stone and someone is bound to destroy it long before nature works its measured erosion. She understood that compulsion, the bitter necessity of refuting monumental achievements, whether they be dressed in stone or in the raiment of poetry. Power possessed 1,000 faces, and one would be hard-pressed to find a beautiful one among them.
No, they were ugly, one and all, and if they managed to create something wondrous, then the memory of its maker must be made to suffer all the more for it.
"For every soul sweeping away the dust," said a voice behind her, "there are 1,000 scattering it by the handful."
Kilmandaros did not turn round, but bared her teeth nonetheless.
"I was growing impatient."
"It's not rained here for some time. Only the roots of the stones still hold moisture. I have followed your journey in the morning mists, in the damp breaths of the beasts."
After a moment, Mael moved up to stand beside her, his eyes settling on the desecrated altar stone.
"Not your handiwork, I see. Feeling cheated?"
"I despise conceit," she said.
"And so every mortal creation is to be crushed by your fists. Yes, the presumption of all those fools."
"Do you know where they have gone, Mael?"
He sighed. "The holds are not as they once were. Have you considered they may not return?"
"Erastus is their master."
"Was, actually. The holds have not had a master for tens of thousands of years, Kilmandaros. Do you know, you forced the errant's retreat from the holds. He feared you were coming for him, to destroy him and his precious creations."
"He was right, I was."
"See how things have turned out. His summoning compelled none of us. You must realize that."
"That is no matter."
"Because deceiving him continues to serve your purposes, and now Knuckles walks at his side, or more accurately, a step behind. When will the knife strike?"
"My son understands the art of subtlety."
"It's not an art, Kilmandaros. It's just one among many tactics to get what you want. The best subtlety is when no one even notices what you've done, ever. Can Sechul Lath achieve that?"
"Can you?"
she retorted. Mael smiled.
"I know of only a few capable of such a thing. One is mortal and my closest friend. The other wasn't mortal, but is now dead. And then, of course, there is Draconis."
She fixed a glare upon him.
"Him? You must be mad."
Mael shrugged. "Try this for a consideration. Draconis needed to get something done, and it now seems he achieved it. Without lifting a hand, without anyone even noticing his involvement. Only one man ever defeated him. Only one man could possess Dragnipur but never kneel before it. Only one man could oversee the weapon's destruction, no matter the cost. Only one man could force an end to Mother Dark's denial. And only one man could stand in the face of chaos and not blink."
Breath gusted from her in a growl.
"And now that man is dead."
"And Draconis walks free. Draconis has broken Kalor's curse on him. He holds darkness in a blade of annihilation. No longer chained, no longer on the run, no longer haunted by the terrible error in judgment that was Dragnipur."
"All this by his hand? I do not believe it, Mael."
"But that is precisely my point, Kilmandaros, about true subtlety. Will we ever know if what I have just described was all by the consort's hand? No."
"Unless he admits it."
"But who wouldn't?"
"I hate your words, Mael. They gnaw like the waves you love so much."
"We are all vulnerable, Kilmandaros. Don't think Draconis is about to build a little farm in some mountain valley and spend the rest of his days whittling whistles while birds nest in his hair. He knows we're here. He knows we're up to something. Either he's already figured it out, in which case he will come to find us, or he is even now setting out to pull loose all our secret ambitions."
"Who killed Anomanda Rake?"
"Decembre, wielding a sword forged by Rake's own hand."
She was rocked by that, her mind raced.
"Vengeance?"
"None other."
"That weapon always terrified me," she said. "I could never understand why he set it aside."
"Really? The hand that holds it must be pure in its desire. Kilmandaros, Rake yielded it to his brother because his heart was already broken, while Andarist, well, we know that tale.
As the significance of Mael's words struck home, Kilmandaros found she was trembling.
"Andarist," she whispered, that...
But she had no words to describe her feeling. Instead, her hands rose to her face again.
"He is gone," she said, voice catching in a sob. "Anomanda Rake is gone."
Mael spoke, his tone suddenly harsh.
"Leave Decembre alone. He was as much a victim as anyone else involved. Worse, he has been cheated and used, and now his suffering is immeasurable."
She shook her head, the muscles of her jaws creaking.
"I was not thinking of Decembre."
"Kilmandaros, listen well. My thoughts on Draconis, my musings on his possible culpability, they are unproven. Speculations, nothing more. If you seek a confrontation with Draconis, if you seek vengeance, you will die. And it may well be for naught, for perhaps Draconis is innocent of all charges."
"You do not believe that."
"I was but reminding you of the danger he presents to us. How long was he trapped within Dragnipur? What did that do to him, to his mind? Is he even sane anymore? One other thing, and think on this carefully, Kilmandaros. Would Rake have willingly freed a mad Draconis? Has he ever shown a thoughtless side to his decisions? Ever?"
Her eyes narrowed.
"He had a purpose."
Mael's smile was wry.
"Even though he is dead, we find ourselves holding to faith in him. Extraordinary, isn't it?"
"Mother Dark
no longer faces away. And as with darkness, so too it is with
light. God's pillow, Mael. What has he forced upon us?"
"A final accounting, I'd wager. An end to the stupid games. He might as well have locked us all in one room. And no one leaves until we settle things once and for all."
"Bastard!"
"Your grief was rather short-lived, Kilmandaros."
"Because what you say rings true. Yes, Rake would think that way, wouldn't he?"
"Else he could not permit his own death, his removal from the stage. More than just ending Mother Dark's obstreperous peak, he now forces our hands. We are all stirred awake, elders and children both, mortal and immortal."
"To what end?" she demanded. "More blood? A damned ocean's worth?"
"Not if there's a way around it," Mael replied. "To what end, you ask? This, I think. He wants us to deal with the crippled god."
"That pathetic creature? You cannot be serious, Mael."
"The wound ever festers, the poison spreads. That alien god's power is anathema. We need to fix it before we seek anything else, before we lose Karul's gift forever."
"Erastus had other ideas."
"So do you and Setch. So does Olar Athil and Ardata."
"And Draconis too, I would think."
"We cannot know if Anomanda Rake and Draconis spoke. Was a bargain reached between them with Dragnipur? I will free you, Draconis, if..."
"They could not have spoken," said Kilmandaros, "for Rake was killed by vengeance. You said so yourself."
Mael walked over to sit down on one of the blocks of the altar stone.
"Ah, well, there is more to say on that, among other things. Tell me, Kilmandaros, what hold did Erastus choose?"
She blinked.
"Why, the obvious one, death."
"Then I will begin with this curious detail, for I wish to know your thoughts on the, implications.
He looked up and something glinted in his eyes.
"Before Rake met Decembre, he met Hood. Met him and killed him. With Dragnipur."
She stared. Mael continued.
"Two gods were in attendance, that I know of."
"Oh!"
The word came out in a dry rasp.
"Shadow Throne and Cotillion."
Oh, how she wished for a tall, imposing standing stone within her reach, a proud pinnacle of conceit, just there, at the very end of her fist as it swung out its path of ferocious destruction.
"Them!"
Mael watched her flail and stamp about, watched as she descended on one toppled menhir after another, pounding each one into rubble. He scratched at the bristles on his chin.
"Oh, you are indeed clever, Kilmandaros. It all falls home, doesn't it? It all falls home."
He'd wanted her to consider the implications.
So much for being subtle.
Suffering could be borne. When the blood was pure, purged of injustices. Raideral was not like the others, not the same as Rut or pernicious Badal with Sadik ever at her side. She alone possessed the legacy of the Inquisitors, shining bright beneath her almost translucent skin. And among all the others, only Badal suspected the truth.
"I am a child of the Quitters. I am here to complete their work."
She had finally seen her kin on their trail, and now wondered why they did not simply stride into the midst of the Chalmanago to take up the last of these pathetic lives.
"I want to go home, back to Estabance. Please come and get me before it's too late."
Suffering could be borne, but even her unhuman flesh was failing. Each morning she looked upon the survivors of yet another night and trembled with disbelief. She watched them drag the corpses close, and she watched them pick the bones clean and then split them to greedily suck at the marrow.
"Children are quickest to necessity. They can make any world normal. Be careful, daughter, with these humans. To live, they will do anything."
She looked upon Rut's world and saw the truth in her father's words. Withheld, cradled in his arms, he called the stronger ones to him and examined the floppy bags of human skin they now used to trap shards whenever a swarm found the ribby snake. These fleshless, deboned bodies, flung into the air as the locusts descended, drew the creatures as flames drew moths, and when the seething mass struck the ground, the children pounced, stuffing locusts into their mouths by the handful. Rut had found a way to turn the war of attrition, to hunt the hunters of this glass wasteland. His followers were hardened now, all angles and flat eyes. Badal's poems had turned cruel, savage. Abandonment honed shore edges. Sun and heat and crystal horizons had forged a terrible weapon. Braideral wanted to scream to her kin. There in the blurred haze of their wake, she wanted to warn them. She wanted to say, "Hurry, see these survivors! Hurry, before it's too late!" But she dared not slink away. Not even in the deepest of night, beneath the jade spears, they would find out. Badal had made certain that she was watched. Badal knew.
"She has to die. I have to kill her. It would be easy. I am so much stronger than them. I could snap her neck. I could unleash my holy voice for the first time ever, and so force my kin to come to my aid when Rut and Sadik and all the others close on me. I could end this, all of it."
Yet the Inquisitors kept their distance. They must have a reason. Any precipitate act by Braideral could ruin everything. She needed to be patient. Huddled beneath layers of rags, ever careful to stand in the way that humans stood, so limited, so bound by physical imperfections, she watched as Rut walked out ahead of the snake's head, the flicking tongue, Badal would say, before snapping open her mouth and sucking in flies, which she then crunched with obvious relish. The city that awaited them did not look real. Every glimmering line and angle seemed to bite Braideral's eyes. She could barely look in that direction, so powerful was her sense of wrongness. Was it in ruin? It did not seem so. Was it lifeless? It must be. There were no farms, no trees, no rivers. The sky above it was clear, dustless, smokeless. Why then this horror and dread? The humans did not feel as she did. Instead, they eyed the distant towers and open faces of buildings as they would the arrival of a new torment. Diamonds and rubies, gems and shards. And she could see the gauging regard in their eyes, as if they silently asked, "Will this attack us? Can we eat it? Is its need greater than ours? Is any need greater than ours?" Sickened, Brederal watched Rut walk ever closer to the faintly raised track encircling the unwalled city.
He has decided. We are going in, and I can do nothing to stop it.
In knowing, Badal whispered, I am in knowing, always. See her, Sadiq? She hates this. She fears this. We are not as weak as she hopes. Sadiq, listen. We have a prisoner in the Ribby Snake. She is chained to us, even as she pretends her freedom under those rags. See how she holds herself. Her control is failing. The quitter awakens.
Kill her, then, Sadiq pleaded with his eyes. But Badal shook her head.
She would take too many of us down, and the others would help her. Remember how the quitters command? The voice that can drive a man to his knees? No, leave her to the desert, and the city, yes, the city. But is this even true? I could.
She had fled the quitters, made them a thing of her past, and the past was ever dead. It had no hold, no claim upon her. Yet none of this had proved true. The past stalked them. The past was fast closing in. Torn fragments floated through her mind, island memories surrounded in the depthless seas of fear. Tall, gaunt figures, words of slaying, the screams of slaughter.
Quitters.
She caught a fly, crunched it down.
The secret is in his arms, she said. Held. Held is the secret. One day everyone will understand. Do you think it matters, Sadiq? Things will be born. Life will catch fire.
Badal could see that he did not understand, not yet. But he was like all the others. Their time was coming.
The city called to us. Only those it chooses can find it. Once giants walked the world. The sun's rays were snared in their eyes. They found this city and made it a temple, not a place in which to live. It was made to exist for itself.
She had learned so much. When she'd had wings and had journeyed across the world, stealing thoughts, snatching ideas, madness was a gift, even as memories were a curse. She needed to find power, but all she could find within herself was a knotted host of words. Poems were not swords, were they?
Remember temples?
She asked the boy beside her.
Fathers in robes, the bowls filling with coins no one could eat, and on the walls gems winked like drops of blood. Those temples, they were like giant fists built to batter us down, to take our spirits and chain them to worldly fears. We were supposed to shred the skin from our souls and accept the pain and punishment as just. The temples told us we were flawed and then promised to heal us. All we needed to do was pay and pray. Coin for absolution and calluses on the knees. But remember how splendid those robes were. That's what we paid for. And the quitters came among us, down from the north. They walked like the broken, and when they spoke, souls crumpled like eggshells. They came with white hands and left with red hands. Words have power.
She lifted a hand and pointed at the city.
But this temple is different. It was not built for adoration. It was built to warn us. Remember the cities, Sadiq? Cities exist to gather the suffering beneath the killer's sword. Swords, more than anyone could even count. So many swords. In the hands of priests and quitters and merchant houses and noble warriors and slavers and debt holders and keepers of food and water. So many. Cities are mouths, Sadiq, filled with sharp teeth.
She snapped another fly from the air, chewed, swallowed.
Lead them now, she said to the boy beside her. Follow Rut and keep an eye on Brederal. Danger comes. The time of the quitters has arrived. Go, lead them after Rut. Begin.
He looked upon her with alarm, but she waved him away and set out for the snake's tattered tail. The quitters were coming to begin the last slaughter. Inquisitor Sever stood looking down on the body of Brother Belieg, seeing as if for the first time the emaciated travesty of the young man she had once known and loved. On her left was Brother Adroit, breathing fast and shallow, hunched and racked with tremors. The bones of his spine and shoulders were bowed like an old man's, legacy of this journey's terrible deficiencies. His nose was rotting, a raw wound glistening and crawling with flies. To her right was Sister Rail, her gaunt face thin as a hatchet, her eyes rimmed in dull, dry red. She had little hair left, that lustrous mane was long gone, and with it the last vestiges of the beauty she had once possessed. Sister Scorn had collected Belieg's staff, and now leant upon it as would a cripple. The joints of her elbows, high wrists and wrists, were inflamed and swollen with fluids, but Sever knew that strength remained within her. Scorn was the last adjudicator among them. When they had set out to deliver peace upon the last of the South Dwellers, these children, they had numbered 12. Among them, 3 of the original 5 women still lived, and but 1 of the 7 men. Inquisitor Sever accepted responsibility for this tragic error in judgment. Of course, who could have imagined that thousands of helpless children could march league upon league through this tortured land, bereft of shelter, their hands empty, outlasting the wild dogs, the cannibal raiders among the last of the surviving adults, and the wretched parasites swarming the ground and the skies above? No, not one inquisitor could have anticipated this terrible will to survive. Surrender was the easy choice, the simplest decision of all. They should have given up long ago.
And we would now be home, and my mate could stand before his daughter and feel such pride at her courage and purity, that she chose to walk with the human children, that she chose to guide her kin to the delivery of peace. And I would not now be standing above the body of my dead son.
It was understood, it had always been understood, that no human was an equal to the Forkrell assail. Proof was delivered 1,000 times a day, and towards the end, 10,000, as the pacification of the South Kingdoms reached its blessed conclusion. Not once had the Shriven refused their submission, not once had a single pathetic human straightened in challenge. The hierarchy was unassailable. But these children did not accept that righteous truth. In ignorance they found strength, in foolishness they found defiance.
"The city," said Scorn, her voice a broken thing, "we cannot permit it."
Sever nodded.
"The investment is absolute, yes, we cannot hope to storm it."
Adroit said,
"Its own beauty, yes. To challenge would be suicide."
The women turned at that, and he flinched back a step.
"Deny me the clarity of my vision?"
Sever sighed, gaze dropping once more to her dead son.
"We cannot. It is absolute. It shines."
"And now the boy with the baby leads them to it," said Sister Rail. "Unacceptable."
"Agreed," said Sever. "We may fail to return, but we shall not fail in what we set out to do. Adjudicator, will you lead us into peace?"
"I am ready,"
Scorn replied, straightening and holding out the staff.
"Wield this, Inquisitor. My need for it has ended."
She longed to turn away, to reject Scorn's offer.
"My son's weapon, fashioned by my own hands and then surrendered to him. I should never have touched it again."
"Honor him," Scorn said.
"I shall."
She took the iron-shod staff and then faced the others.
"Gather up the last of your strengths. I judge 4,000 remain. A long day of slaughter awaits us."
"They are unarmed,"
said Rail.
"Weak."
"Yes, in the delivering of peace, we will remind them of that truth."
Scorn set out. Sever and the others fell in behind the adjudicator. When they drew closer, they would fan out to make room for the violence they would unleash. Not one Shriven would ever reach the city, and the boy with the baby would die last.
"By my husband's daughter's hand. Because she lives, she still lives."
Something like panic gripped the children, dragging Braderal along in a rushing tide. Swearing, she tried to pull loose, but hands reached out, clutched tight, pushed her onwards. She should have been able to defy them all, but she had overestimated her reserves of strength. She was more damaged than she had believed. She saw Sadik leading this charge, plunging after Rut, who was now almost at the city's threshold. But of Badal there was no sign. This detail frightened her.
"There is something about her. She is transformed, but I do not know how. She is somehow quickened."
Her kin had finally comprehended the danger. They waited no longer. Scuffed, tugged, and pushed, she waited for the first screams behind her.
"Words. I have nothing but words. I cast away many of them, only to have others find me. What can words achieve, here in this hard, real place? But doubts themselves are nothing but words, a troubled song in my head. When I speak, the snakes listen. Their eyes are wide. But what happens to all I say once the words slip into them? Alchemies. Sometimes the mixture froths and bubbles. Sometimes it boils. Sometimes nothing stirs and the potion lies dead, cold and grey as mud. Who can know? Who can predict? I speak softly when all that I say is a howl. I pound upon bone with my fists, and they hear naught but whispers. Savage words will thud against dead flesh. But the slow drip of blood, ah, then they are content as cats at a stream."
Badal hurried along, and it seemed the snake parted as if her passage was ripping it in two. She saw skeletal faces, shining eyes, limbs wrapped in skin dry as leather. She saw thigh bones from ribbers picked up on the trail, held like weapons, but what good would they do against the quitters?
"I have words and nothing else, and in these words I have no faith. They cannot topple walls, they cannot crush mountains down to dust."
The faces swam past her. She knew them all, and they were nothing but blurs, each one smeared inside tears.
"But what else is there? What else can I use against them? They are quitters. They claim power in their voice."
The islands in her mind were drowning.
"I too seek power in my words. Have I learned from them? This is how it seems. Is this how it is?"
Stragglers. The sickened, the weakened, and then she was past them all, standing alone on the glass plain. The sun made the world white, bitter with purity. This was the perfection so cherished by the quitters.
"But it was not the quitters who cut down our world. They only came in answer to the death of our gods, our faith, when the rains stopped, when the last green withered and died. They came in answer to our prayers. Save us from ourselves."
Emerging from the heat shimmer, four figures fast closing. Like wind-rocked puppets, every limb snapped back until broken, wheeling loose, and death surrounded them in whirlwinds. Monstrous, clambering out of her memories, swirls of power, she saw mouths open.
"Yield!"
The command rushed through Badal, hammered children to the ground behind her. Voices crying out, helpless with dread. She felt it rage against her will, weakening her knees. She felt a snap as if a tether had broken, and all at once she lifted free. She saw the ribby snake, the sinuous length stretched out as if in yearning, but segment by segment it writhed in pain. As that command thundered from bone to bone, Badal found her voice.
"Power in the word, but I can answer it. To the assault of wonder, humility takes you in hand."
She spun back down to lock herself behind her own eyes. She saw energies whirl away, ignite in flashes.
"Halt!"
Cracking like a fist, lips split, blood threading down. Badal spat, pushed forward, one step, only one.
"In softest silence, enfold the creeping doubt."
She saw her words strike them, stagger them, almost close enough, at last, to see their ravaged faces, the disbelief, the bafflement and growing distress, the indignation, and yes, that she understood, games of meaning in evasion, deceit of intent in sleight of hand. Badal took another step.
Yield all these destinations, unbidden jostle to your bones, halt in the shadow thrown beneath the yoke of dismay.
She felt fire in her limbs, saw blinding incandescence erupt from her hands. Truth was such a rare weapon, and all the more deadly for it.
Do not give me your words. They are dead with the squalor of your empty virtues. Yield to your own lies. Halt in the breathless moment. Your lungs scream and silence answers. Your heart drums. Brittle surfaces bleed.
They staggered back as if blinded. Blue fluid spurted from ruptured joints, gushed down from gaping mouths. Agony twisted their angled faces. One fell, thrashing, kicking on the ground. Another, a woman closer to Badal than the others, dropped down onto her knees, and their impact with the crystalline ground was marked by two bursts of bluish blood. The quitter shrieked. The remaining two, a man and a woman, reeling as if buffeted by invisible fists, had begun retreating, stumbling, half running. The fires within Badal flared and then died. The quitters deserved worse, but she did not have it in her to deliver such hard punishment. They had given her but two words, not enough.
Two words, obedience to the privilege of dying. Accept your fate, but we will not. We refuse. We have been refusing things for a long time now. We are believers in refusal. They will not come close now, not for a long time. Maybe for these ones, never again. I have hurt them. I took their words and made them my own. I made the power turn in their hands and cut them. It will have to do.
She turned round. The ribby snake had begun moving again, strangely mindless as if beaten by drovers, senseless as a herd of cattle crossing a...
A river? But when have I seen a river?
She blinked, licked salty blood from her lips. Flies danced. The city awaited them.
It is what we can bear, she whispered. But there is more to life than suffering. Now we must find it.
Darkness passed, and yet it remained. A splinter pure, promising annihilation. Onos Tulan could sense it, somewhere ahead, a flickering, wavering presence. His stride, unbroken for so long, now faltered. The bitter rage within him seemed to stagger, sapped of all strength. Depression rose like floodwaters, engulfing all sense of purpose. The tip of his sword bit the ground. Vengeance meant nothing, even when the impulse was all-consuming. It was a path that, once started upon, could conceivably stretch on forever. The culpable could stand in a line reaching past the horizon. An avenger's march was endless. So it had been with the vengeance sought against the Jaghut, and Onos Tulan had never been blind to the futility of that. Was he nothing but an automaton, stung into motion that would never slow in step? He felt a sudden pressure wash over him from behind. Baffled, all at once frightened, his weapon's stone tip carving a furrow in the dry soil, the first sword slowly swung round. He could deny, he could refuse, but these choices would not lead him to the knowledge he sought. He had been forced back from the realms of death. The blood ties he had chosen had been severed. No longer a husband, a father, a brother. He had been given vengeance, but what vengeance could he find sifting through a valley heaped with corpses? There were other purposes, other reasons for walking this pathetic world once again. Onos Tulan had been denied his rightful end. He intended to find out why. Not one among the thousand or so Tulani Mas approaching him had yet touched his thoughts. They walked enshrouded in silence, ghosts, kin reduced to strangers. He waited. Children of the ritual, yes, but his sense of many of them told him otherwise. There was mystery here, T'lani Mas, and yet, when all the others halted their steps, 6 bonecasters emerged, continuing their approach. He knew 3, Brolas Horan, Uleg Togtil, Ilmeb Sinos, bonecasters of the Orshain T'lani Mas. The Orshain had failed to appear at Silver Fox's gathering. Such failure invited presumptions of loss, extinction, fates to match those of the Ifail, the Bentract, the Kerloom. The presumption had been erroneous. The remaining 3 were wrong in other ways. They were clothed in the furs of the white bear, a beast that had come late in the age of the Imas, and their faces were flatter, the underlying structures more delicate than that of true Imas. Their weapons were mostly bone, ivory, tusk or antler, with finely chipped chert and flint insets, weapons defying the notion of finesse, intricate in their construction, and yet the violence they would deliver promised an almost primitive brutality. Bonecaster Uleg Togtil spoke.
First sword, who knew dust could be so interesting?
There was a frustrated hiss from Brolas Horan.
He insists on speaking for us, and yet he never says what we wish him to say. Why we ever acquiesce is a mystery. I have my own paths, Uleg said easily, and I do not imagine the first sword lacks patience.
Not patience, snapped Brolas, but what about tolerance?
Bone bends before it breaks, Brolas Horan. Now, I would say more to the first sword before we all await the profundity of his words. May I?
Brolas Horan half turned to Ilmeb Sinos, one hand lifting in an odd gesture that baffled Omos Tulan for a moment before he understood. Helplessness.
First sword, Uleg resumed. We do not reach to you in the manner of Telan, because we make no claim upon you. We are summoned, yes, but it was, we have come to believe, not by your hand. You may refuse us. It is not in our hearts to force ourselves upon the will of another.
Onos Tulan said,
Who are these strangers? Profound indeed, Uleg said. First sword, they are T'lani Mas of a second ritual. The descendants of those who sought to follow Kilava Onas when she rejected the first ritual. It was their failure not to determine beforehand Kilava's attitude to being accompanied. But when there is but one hole in the ice, then all must use it to breathe. My sister invited no one. Alas, and so it comes to this. These 3 are bonecasters of the brawled T'lani Mas. Lid Jer, Leira Epar, and Nom Kala. The brawled number 2712. The majority of these remain in the dust of our wake. Our own Orshain number 612. You see them here. If you need us, we shall serve.
Nom Kala studied the first sword, this warrior she had once believed was nothing but an invention, a myth. Better, she concluded, had he remained so. His bones were latticed, as if he had been pounded into fragments, and some of those bones were not even his own. The first sword was not the giant of the legends. He did not wear a cloak of ice. Caribou antlers did not sprout from his head. He did not possess breath that gave the gift of fire. Nor did he seem the kind of warrior to recount his exploits for 3 days and 4 nights to belittle an overly proud hero. She began to suspect few of those ancient tales belonged to this figure at all. Dancing across the sea on the backs of whales, crossing swords with demon walruses in their underwater towers, the secret seducer of wives left alone at night. How many children among her clan, generation upon generation, bore some variation of the name Onos to account for impossible pregnancies? The sudden, shocked gulp that erupted from her drew everyone's attention. Brolas Horan had been speaking, about what Nomkala had no idea, and he was not pleased with the interruption.
Nomkala, what is it about the fall at the Red Spires that so amuses you?
Nothing, she replied, unless it was meant to. I apologize, Brolos Haran. A stray thought. Well, a few stray thoughts.
The others waited. She elected to refrain from elaborating. The wind moaned, whispered through remnants of fur. Onos Tulan spoke.
Orshane, Brold, I have forsworn the Jaghut Wars. I seek no battle. I do not invite you to join me, for what I seek is an accounting. Like you, I am summoned from the dust, and it is to dust that I wish to return. But first, I will find the one who has so punished me with resurrection, the bone caster of the Logros Tlani Mas, Olar Ethil.
Ulag said,
Can you be certain it is her first sword?
Onos Tulan cocked his head.
Ulag Togtil, after all this time, do you still hold to the virtue of certainty?
We fought no war against the Jaghut, Nomkala said.
The bone casters of the Orshane reacted with a chill wave of disapproval. She ignored it. Onos Tulan said,
Ulag, I see the Orshane war leader standing with your kin. Why does Innistral Ovan not come forward? He is shamed, First Sword. The losses at the Red Spire.
Nomkala, Onos then said,
Have you no ruler of the Brawled Clan?
Only us, she replied. Even the war we fought against the humans was not a war that demanded a war leader. It was clear that we could not defeat them on a field of battle. There were too many.
Then how did you fight?
By keeping alive our stories, our ways of living, and by hiding, for in hiding we survived. We persisted. This is itself a victory.
And yet, cut in Ilmabsinos, you failed in the end, else you would not have attempted the ritual of Telan.
That is true, she replied. We ran out of places to hide.
Ulag spoke.
First Sword, we would accompany you nonetheless. Like you, we wish to know the purpose of our return.
If you join my quest, said Onos Tulan,
then you bow to Olar Ethil's desires. That perception may lead to carelessness on her part, Ulag replied.
Standing amidst the other Tlani Mas, Ristal Ev watched, listened, and imagined a world taught with purpose. It had once been such a world, for her, for all of her kin, but that had vanished long ago. Perhaps the First Sword could bind them all to this quest of his. Perhaps answers could relieve the burden of despair. Reasons to stand, reasons to stand against. But the dust beckoned with its promise of oblivion. The trail to the end of things had been hacked clear, pounded level. She yearned to walk it. Beside her, Kalt Urmanal said,
See the sword he carries. See how its tip pins the earth. This Onos Tulan, he is not one for poses. He never was. I remember when I last saw him, he had defeated his challenger. He had shown such skill that 10,000 Imas stood silent with awe. Yet he stood as one defeated.
Weary,
Ristal murmured.
Yes, but not from the fighting. He was weary, Ristal Ev, of its necessity.
She considered that and then nodded. Kalt then added,
This warrior I will follow.
Yes.
She sat on a pyramid of three stacked canvas bolts, huddled beneath her nightcloak. The shivering would not go away. She watched the glowing tip of her smoker dancing like a firefly close to her fingers. Atrisida Arenict listened to the muted sounds of the Malazan encampment, subdued, weary, and shaken. She understood that well enough. Soldiers had fallen out from the column, staggering as if reeling from blows, collapsing senseless or falling to their knees, spitting blood, panic rippling through the ranks. Was this an attack?
Not as such.
Those stricken soldiers had been, one and all, mages, and the enemy, blind and indifferent, had been power. Her nausea was fading, mind slowly awakening, wandering like a hungover reveller, desultorily sweeping aside the ashes. She thought back to her first meeting with High Mage Ben Adifon Dalat. She had been pathetic. It was bad enough fainting in a heap in front of Commander Bryce Bedict. She had barely recovered from that before she was led into Quick Ben's presence. And now, weeks later, only fragments of the conversation that followed remained with her. He had been a distracted man, but when he had seen the enlivened earth cupped in Aranicht's hand, his dark eyes had sharpened, hardened as if transformed into onyx. He had cursed, and she remembered that curse.
Hood's frantic balls on the fire.
She had since discovered that Hood was the god of death, and that if any god deserved its name being uttered in bitter curses, then he was the one. At the time, however, she had taken the High Mage's expostulation somewhat more literally. Fire, she'd thought. Yes, fire in the earth, heat cupped in my hand. Her eyes had widened on the High Mage, astonished at his instant percipience, convinced in that moment of his profound genius. She had no place in his company. Her mind moved in a slow crawl at the best of times, especially in the early morning before she'd drawn alive the coal of her first smoker. Quickness of thought, and there, she'd assumed, must be the reason for his name, was in itself a thing of magic, a subtle sorcery, which she could only view with superstitious awe. Such lofty opinion could persist only in the realm of mystery, however, and mystery rarely survived familiarity. The High Mage had formally requested that she be temporarily attached to his cadre. Since then, she'd heard plenty of curses from Ben Adifon Dalat, and had come to conclude that his quickness was less sorcerous than quixotic. Oh, he was indeed brilliant. He was also in the habit of muttering to himself in a host of entirely distinct voices, and playing with dolls and lengths of string, and as for the company he kept. She pulled fiercely on her smoker, watching a figure approach, walking like a drunk, his ill-fitting, cheap clothing caked in dust. Bottle's strangely childlike face looked swollen, almost dissolute.
Here we go. Yet another incomprehensible conversation between them. And oh, he doesn't like me being there for it either. That makes two of us.
Is he breathing?
The Malazan soldier asked as he halted in front of the tent. She glanced at the drawn flap to her left.
He sent me out, she said.
He'll want to see me.
He wants to know how Fiddler fared.
Bottle grimaced, looked away briefly, then back down to her, seeming to study her.
You've got sensitivity, Atreseda. A draught of rum will soothe your nerves.
I've already had one.
He nodded, as if unsurprised.
Fiddler's still losing what's left of his supper. He'll need a new tent.
But he's not even a mage.
No, he isn't.
She fixed her eyes on him.
Are all you Malazans this cagey?
He smiled.
And we're getting worse, Atreseda.
Why is that?
The smile dropped away, like it never really fitted in the first place.
It's simple enough. The less we know, the less we say. Pretty soon, I expect, we'll be an army of mutes.
I can't wait.
Sighing, she flicked away the smoker, slowly rose. The stars were returning to the sky in the northeast. At least that was something.
But someone's out there, holding a weapon. God, such a weapon. Erend's bouncing eye, she said. He's the High Mage. He can't hide forever.
Bottle's eyes were wide on her.
Never heard that curse before, he said.
I just made it up.
Seems oddly irreverent coming from a Letheri. I'm slightly shocked, in fact.
It's all your bad habits, I suppose.
She stepped to the tent flap and wrapped the hide with her knuckles.
We're coming in.
Fine,
came the snapped reply. The cramped interior was steamy, as scented candles flickered from the floor in a circle surrounding a cross-legged Quick Ben. The High Mage dripped with sweat.
"Bastard's reaching out to me," he said, voice grating. "Do I want a conversation? No, I do not. What's to say? Anamander killed Hood. Dasem killed Anamander. Brood shattered Dragnipur, and now Draconis walks free. Burn trembles. The gate of Starval Demelane rages with fire, and cruel twisted warrens, the like of which we've never before seen, now lie in wait. When will they awaken? What will they deliver? And there's more. Do you realize that? There's more. Stop staring. Just listen. Who brokered the whole damned mess? Bottle?
Sorry, I was listening, not thinking. How should I know? No, wait.
Aye, Shadow Throne and Cotillion. Does the adjunct really believe she chooses her own path, our path? She's been driving us hard ever since we landed. Sure, it's all a matter of logistics. It's not like the Akrin traders are happily handing over everything they have, is it? It's not like things won't get worse the further east we march. The wastelands are well named.
Quick, Ben.
Of course I'm babbling. Listen, there are Tlani Mas out there.
His wild gaze fixed with sudden intensity on Erenicht.
The dust will dance. Who commands them? What do they want? Do you know what I want to do with that dirt? I want to throw it away. Who wants to know? Not me.
The Tlani Mas, said Bottle, knelt to the Emperor. He took the first throne and never relinquished it.
Exactly.
We're being set up. We need to speak with Tavare now.
But the High Mage was shaking his head.
It's no use. She's made up her mind.
About what?
Bottle demanded, his voice rising.
She thinks she can cheat them. Did you know she was the preeminent scholar of the lives of Kelanved, Dancer and Dasem? You didn't, did you? Before she was made adjunct. Even before she inherited command of House Paran. A student of war, imperial war. The conquests, not just tactics on the field, but the motivations of the Emperor and his mad cohorts. The lives of them all. Crust, Tok the Elder, Urko, Amaron, Admiral Nock, Surly, even Taishren. Why do you think she keeps Banaskar around? That drunk fool is her potential emissary, should Taishren finally decide to do something.
But Bottle was clearly stuck at Quick Ben's first revelation.
Cheat them? Cheat the Lords of Shadow? Cheat them of what?
Quick Ben's bad teeth glimmered like gold in the flickering candlelight.
I dare not say.
You don't trust us to keep our mouths shut?
No. Why would I?
He pointed a long finger at Bottle.
You'd be the first one running for the hills.
If it's that bad, why are you still here?
Because Draconis changes everything, and I'm the only one who can stand against him.
Bottle gaped, and then a thin word creaked out.
You?
But don't think for a moment that I'm doing it for Shadowthrone and Cotillion. And don't think I'm even doing this for the adjunct. All that time inside Dragnipur, it's changed him. He was never so subtle before. Imagine, a gentle invitation to converse. Does he think we're idiots? But wait, and he waved his hands. It'd only be subtle if it wasn't so obvious.
Why didn't we think of that? Because it makes no sense, you damned fool.
But the High Mage did not react to Bottle's outburst.
No, he really wants to talk. Now that's subtle for you. Well, we can match that, can't we? Talk? Not a chance. No, and let's see what he makes of it. Let's just see.
Erenicht ran both hands through the thick hair on her scalp, and then rummaged in her belt bag for a smoker. She crouched and snatched up one of Quick Ben's candles. As she was lighting up, she happened to glance across at the High Mage and saw him staring, his expression frozen. Bottle grunted a laugh.
She ain't so shy anymore, is she? Good. Now we'll find out the real Atreseda, just like Bryce wanted.
Behind a veil of swirling smoke, Erenicht's gaze narrowed on Quick Ben. She slowly returned the candle to its pool of melted wax on the hide floor.
Bryce, is that what all this is about?
The High Mage shot Bottle a disdainful look.
It's ignorance, not bravado.
Bravado usually is ignorance, Bottle snapped back.
I'll grant you that, Quick Ben conceded. And you're right, he added, sighing. We could do with a little more of the unflappable around here.
Aranicht snorted. Unflappable? You're not describing me.
Maybe not, the High Mage replied, but you manage a convincing pose. That candle you took from the Circle of Protection, you opened a pathway to Draconis. He sensed it immediately, and yet...
He didn't use it, Bottle said.
He didn't use it.
Subtle?
Ha ha, Bottle, but you're more right than you know. The point is, she made us address that so fiercely burning question, didn't she?
Unknowingly.
Quick Ben glanced up at her, curious, thoughtful. Aranik shrugged.
I needed the flame.
The reply seemed to please them both, in rather different ways. She decided to leave it at that. What point was there in explaining that she'd no idea what they'd been talking about? All those names Quick Ben mentioned, even Draconis, they meant nothing to her. Well, almost nothing.
Draconis. He is the one who arrived in darkness, who made a gate that stole half the sky, who holds in his hand a weapon of darkness and cold, of blackest ice. And Quick Ben means to stand in his path. Errant's mangled nuts. I only joined because I'm lusting after Bryce Bedict, me and 1,000 other women.
Quick Ben said,
Atreseda, your commander, Bryce.
She started guiltily. Had he read her thoughts?
He died once, didn't he?
What? Yes, so it is said. I mean, yes, he did.
The High Mage nodded.
Best go see him, then. He may have need of you right now.
Me? Why?
Because Hood is gone, said Bottle.
What does that mean to Commander Bedict?
She asked. She saw Bottle meet Quick Ben's eyes, and then the soldier nodded and said,
The dead never quite come back all the way, Aranicht. Not while there was a god of death. It may be that Bryce is now awakened to everything he once was. He will have things to say to his Atreseda.
We'll see you again, Quick Ben added. Or not.
They dismiss me. Oh, well.
She turned and exited the tent, paused in the sultry darkness of the camp, drew deep on her smoker, and then set out for the distant Lethary encampment.
Bryce wants me. What a lovely thought.
Smiles threw herself down by the fire.
Stupid patrols, she said. There's no one out there. Those Akrin traders, all creaking old or snot-nosed runts.
She glanced at the others sitting round the hearth.
See that village we passed yesterday? Looked half empty.
No warriors, said Cuttle. All off fighting the white faces. The Akrin can't maintain control of this Kryn free trade right now, which also explains all those Duras traders coming up from the south.
Targ grunted.
Heard from some outriders about a Bargast camp they came on, sight of a big battle, and looks like the white faces got blooded. Might be they're on the run, just like the Akrin are saying.
Hard to believe that, Cuttle countered. I've fought Bargast, and it's no fun at all. And the white faces are said to be the toughest of the lot.
Smiles unstrapped her helm and pulled it off.
Where's Corrick, then? She asked.
Wandered off, Tar answered, tossing another dung chip onto the fire.
Again, he added. Smiles hissed. That fever, it marked him in the head.
Just needs a good scrap, Cuttle ventured. That'll settle him right enough.
Could be a long wait, Tar said. We've got weeks and weeks of travel ahead of us, through mostly empty territory. Aye, we're covering ground awfully fast, but once we're done with the territories of these plains tribes, it'll be the wastelands. No one can even agree how far across it is, or what's on the other end.
He shrugged. An army's deadliest enemy is boredom, and we're under siege these days.
Korab not back yet? Smiles shook her head. He had two heavies with him on the round. They might have got lost.
Someone will find them, Cuttle said, climbing to his feet. I'll check in on the sergeant again.
Smiles watched him step out of the firelight. She sighed.
Ain't had me a knife fight in months. That stay in Letharus made us soft, and them barges was even worse.
She stretched her boots closer to the fire.
I don't mind the marching, now the blisters are gone. At least we're squads again.
We need us a new scam, Tar said. You see any scorpions?
Sure, plenty, Smiles replied. But only two kinds, the little nasty ones and the big black ones. Besides, we try that again and people will get suspicious, even if we could find a good cheat.
She mulled on the notion for a time and then shook her head.
It's no good, Tar. The mood's all wrong.
He squinted across at her. Sharp, you're right. It's like we're past all that, and it'll never come again. Amazing that I should feel nostalgic about Seven Cities and that miserable, useless march. We were raw, aye, but what we were trying to do, it made sense. That's the difference. It made sense.
Smiles snorted. Hood's breath, Tar.
What?
Cuttle's right. None of it made sense. Never did, never will. Look at us. We march around and cut up other people, and they do the same to us, if they can. Look at Letha. Ah, it's now got a decent king, and people can breathe easy and go about their lives. But what's in those lives? Scraping for the next bag of coins, the next meal. Scrubbing bowls, praying to the damned gods for the next catch and calm seas. It ain't for nothing, Tar, and that's the truth. It ain't for nothing.
That fishing village you come from was a real haul, wasn't it?
Leave it.
I didn't bring it up, soldier. You did.
It was no different from anywhere else, that's my point. I bet you wasn't sorry to get out from wherever you come from, either. If it was all you wanted, you wouldn't be here, would you?
Some people don't go through their lives searching, Smiles. I'm not looking, because I'm not expecting to find anything. You want meaning? Make it up. You want truth? Invent it. Makes no difference to anything. Sun comes up, sun goes down. We see one, maybe we don't see the other, but the sun doesn't care, does it?
Right, she said. So we're in agreement.
Not quite. I'm not saying it's not worth it, I'm saying the opposite. You make worlds, worlds inside your head and worlds outside, but only the one inside counts for anything. It's where you find peace, acceptance, worth. You're just talking about everything being useless, starting with yourself. That's a bad attitude, Smiles, worse than Cuttle's.
Where are we marching to, then?
Fate's got a face, and we're going to meet it eye to eye. The rest I don't care about.
So you'll follow the adjunct, anywhere, like a dog on a master's heel.
Why not? It's all the same to me.
I don't get you.
There's nothing to get. I'm a soldier, and so are you. What more do you want?
I want a damned war.
It's coming.
What makes you so sure of that?
Because we're an army on the march. If the adjunct didn't need an army, she'd have dissolved the whole thing in Letha.
Maybe, maybe not.
What do you mean? He asked.
I mean, maybe she's just selfish.
The dung burned down to layered glowing chips. Moths spun round the licking flames. Silence descended on the two soldiers, who had nothing more to say to each other, at least for this night. Cuttle found his sergeant lying on the floor. A jug of rum lay on its side close by. The confined space reeked of puke, with the rum's heady layer settling on it like sweet sap.
Damn it, Fid! That won't help your gut. I ain't got a gut no more,
Fiddler replied in a slur.
I tossed it up a bell ago. Come the morning, your skull's gonna crack open. Too late. Go away, Cole.
The sapper drew one edge of the cot closer and settled down.
Who was it, then? It's all changed, Cole. It's all going bad. That's news to me. Listen, this fast march, I've already worn out one pair of boots, but it's got to tell you something. The adjunct, she's got a nose. She can sniff things out better than you, I think. Ever since the barges, we've been damned near on the run. And even before what happened tonight, you've been a haunted man.
He rubbed at the bristle on his cheeks.
I'll follow you, Fid, you know that. I've got your back always.
Don't mind me, Cull. It's the young ones, you got to guard their backs, not mine.
You're seeing a lot of dead faces, aren't you?
I ain't no seer,
Cuttle grunted.
It's a precious day, you ain't talking it up. Squad's the thing, you keep telling them. The soldier at your side, the one whose sweat stink you smell every damned day. We're family, you say. Sergeant, you're making us nervous.
Fiddler slowly sat up, clutched at his head.
Fishing, he said.
What?
There's a demon in the deep, sly eyes. Watching the bait, you see? Just watching. Quick, Ben. He's got to show himself. Finally. We need him. We need him all.
Fid, you're drunk.
Darkness got an edge. Sharp, the blackest ice. Cold like you never imagined. You don't get it. Here we was, all yipping and dancing. But now the biggest wolf of all has returned. Games are over, Cuttle.
What about the adjunct? Fiddler?
He looked up with red, bleary eyes.
She don't stand a chance. God's below, not a chance.
Is that the camp? It's got to be.
Korab looked at his companions. Three blank faces stared back at him.
It's all lit up. Too big for a caravanserai. Let's go.
He led the way down the grassy slope, waving as a cloud of midges rose to engulf them.
We should never have followed that rabbit. This is no place to get lost in. Didn't I say that? The land rolls too much. You could hide whole armies in these valleys.
Maybe that's what they did, Saltlick said. Hey, Korab, did you think of that? They're playing a trick on us.
The whole Bone Hunter army? That's stupid.
It was a big rabbit, said Drawfirst.
It wasn't a rabbit at all, Saltlick insisted. It was a wolf. Rabbits ain't got glowing eyes and a bloody muzzle, and they don't snarl neither.
It got a bloody muzzle biting you, Drawfirst pointed out.
Passed right by me. Who wouldn't jump on it being so close? It's dark out here, you know, but I jumped on rabbits before, and that was no rabbit. Beasts are different here, Drawfirst said. We keep hearing howling, but that could be rabbits. How do we know? Did you see those lizard hides them Duras was selling? Those lizards was even bigger than the ones we saw from the barge. Those lizards could eat a horse.
That's how they catch 'em down south. That's what the trader said. They stick a big hook through a horse and throw it in the river.
That won't work unless you tie a rope to the hook. He didn't mention that, but it makes sense.
They were drawing closer to the sea of campfires. Well, Korab amended, maybe not a sea, more like a big lake, but an awfully big lake. He glanced over at Flashwit, who wasn't saying much, but then she rarely did. All she did was smile, and wasn't it a lovely smile? It was.
If we hooked a rabbit, said Saltlick, we could catch wolves.
Hook a horse and we'd get an even bigger wolf, I bet.
We got horses too. That's an idea, Drawfirst. It surely is. Hey, Korab, we're going to jump the next big lizard we see for its skin. You want in?
No.
A distant howl sounded, drifting mournfully through the night.
Hear that?
Saltlick asked.
More rabbits. Keep an eye out, Drawfirst. You too, Flashwit.
That sounded more like a hooked horse,
Drawfirst muttered. Korab halted.
Cut it out, all of you. I'm Fidz Heavy, right? I stand just like you do.
He pointed at Flashwit.
Don't even think of winking. I spent half my life making mistakes about people, and I vowed I'd never do that again. So I keep my peace, but I pay attention, right? I'm a heavy too, so stop it.
We was just having fun, Korab, Saltlick said. You could always join in.
I don't believe in funny things. Now, come on. We've done enough walking.
They walked a further 20 paces before a sentry in the gloom ahead barked something in Lethary.
Hood's breath, hissed Korab. We done found the other army.
Nobody can hide from the Bone Hunters,
intoned Drawfirst. Korik stood in darkness, 100 paces out from the nearest picket. He had a memory that might be real or invented. He could not be certain. 12 youths commandeered to dig a latrine trench for some garrison troop out on manoeuvres. Seti and Seti half-bloods,
back when they were young enough to see no difference between the two, no reason yet for contempt, envy, and all the rest. He'd been one of the runts, and so his friends set him against a boulder at the far end of the pit, where he could strain and sweat and fail. Blistered hands struggling with the oversized pick, he had worked the whole morning trying to dislodge that damned boulder, with the others looking over every now and then with jeers and laughter. Failure wasn't a pleasant notion. It stung. It burned like acid. On that day, he now believed, young Corrick had decided he would never again accept failure. He dislodged that boulder in the end, with dusk fast coming on, the other boys long gone, and that troop of riders, their little exercise in independence done, riding off in a cloud that hung like a god's mocking breath of gold dust. That rock had been firmly lodged in place. It had hidden a cache of coins. As twilight crept in, he found himself on his knees at one end of the trench, with a vast treasure cupped in his hands, mostly silver, a few tiny gold clips, not one recognizable to Corrick's pathetically limited experience. This was a spirit hoard, straight out from Seti legends.
Under any stone, lad?
Yes, the whores who'd raised him had plenty of tales. Could be the whole memory was just one of those tales. A pathetic story, but he'd found a treasure. That was the meaning of it. Something precious, wonderful, rare. And what did he do with his spirit hoard?
Squandered it. Every last fucking coin. Gone. And what was left to show for it? Whores are warm to the touch, but they hide their souls inside a cold keep. It's when you surrender to that world that you know you are truly lost. You are finally alone. It's all cold to the touch these days. Everything. And now I spend the rest of my years blaming every damned coin. But nobody's fooled, except me. Always me. Forever me.
He longed to draw his sword, to vanish into the mad mayhem of battle. He could then cut in two every face on every coin, howling that it made a difference, that a life wasn't empty if it was filled with detritus. He could scream and curse and see not a single friend, only enemies, justifying every slice, every lash of blood. At the very least, he vowed, he'd be the last one standing. Smiles said the fever had scarred him. Perhaps it had. Perhaps it would from now on. It had done one thing for certain. It had shown him the truth of solitude, and that truth was seared into his soul. He listened to Fiddler going on and on about this so-called family of companions, and he believed none of it. Betrayals stalked the future. He felt it in his bones. There was coming a time when everything would cut clear, and he could stand before them all and speak aloud the fullest measure of his distrust.
We are each of us alone. We always were. I am done with all your lies. Now save yourselves, as I intend to do for myself.
He wasn't interested in any last stands. The adjunct asked for faith, loyalty. She asked for honesty, no matter how brutal, how incriminating. She asked for too much. Besides, she gave them nothing in return, did she? Corrick stood, facing the empty land in the empty night, and contemplated deserting.
Everything they gave me was a lie, a betrayal. It was the spirit hoard, you see, those coins. Someone put them there to lure me in, to trap me. They poisoned me. Not my fault. How could it be? Look at him under that boulder. Careful, Corrick. Playing under there will get you crushed.
Too late.
It was all those fucking coins that did me in. You can't fill a boy's hands like that. You just can't.
It was a memory. Maybe real, maybe not. The whores, they just wink. Scannero's lithe form rippled with shadows as someone outside the tent walked past bearing a lantern. The light coming through the canvas was cool, giving her sleeping form a deathly hue. Chilled by the vision, Ruthen Gud looked away. He sat up, moving slowly to keep her from waking. The sweat that had sheathed him earlier was drying on his skin. He had no interest in revisiting the cause of his extremity. It wasn't the lovemaking, Hood knew. As pleasing as she was, with that sudden smile of hers that could melt mountains of ice, Scannero didn't have it in her to send his heart thundering the way it had not long ago. She could delight, she could steal him away from his thoughts, his memories of a grim and eventful life. She could, in bright, stunning flashes, give him back his life. But this night, darkness had opened its flower with a scent that could freeze a god's soul.
Still alive, Greymane? Did you feel it? I think your bones could be rotting in the ground right now, old friend, and still you'd have felt it. Draconis. Fuck.
He combed through the damp snarl of his beard.
The world shook, balls of fire descending, the terrible light filling the sky, fists hammering the world. Wish I'd seen it.
But he remembered the Azath's death cry. He remembered the gnarled trees engulfed in pillars of flames, the bitter heat of the soil he'd clawed through. He remembered staggering free beneath a crazed sky of lurid smoke, lightning and a deluge of ashes. He remembered his first thought, riding that breath of impossible freedom.
Jakoruku, you've changed.
One found loyalty under the strangest circumstances. Penitence and gratitude, arms entwined, a moment's lustful exultation mistaken for worship. His gaze flicked back to Scannero. The shadows and ill hue were gone. She slept, beauty in repose. Innocence was so precious.
But do not think of me with love, woman. Do not force upon me a moment of confession, the truth of foolish vows uttered a lifetime ago. Let us play this game of blissful oblivion a little while longer. It's better this way, Draconis. This is Kalor's empire, friend. Will you not reconsider? Reconsider. Yes, there is that. The shore seems welcoming enough, if I mind my own business. He'd smiled at that, and I smiled back. Draconis returned to that continent. I felt his footfalls there inside my seemingly eternal prison. He returned to see for himself the madness of Kalor. You were right, Draconis. I should have minded my own business for once. Can you hear me now, Draconis? Are you listening? I have reconsidered at long last, and so I give you this. Find me, and one of us will die.
It's the swirl in the dog's fur.
Balm stared.
What?
Widdershin scowled.
You want this divination or not?
I ain't so sure no more.
The mage stared down at the mangy creature he held by the scruff of the neck, and then snarled and sent it winging through the air. Dead smell and balm and throat slitter watched the thing twist smartly in the air and manage in the last possible instant to land splayed out wide on its four paws, whereupon, with a flick of its bushy tail, it bolted, vanishing into the night.
Just like a damned cat,
throat slitter said.
Wasn't even a dog,
dead smell said. Widdershins threw up a hand in dismissal.
Dog, fox, what's the difference? Now I'll need to find something else.
How about a sheepskin?
Balm asked.
Is a sheepskin alive? No, won't work. Needs to be breathing.
Because breathing fluffs the swirls, Balm said, nodding. I get it.
Widdershins cast a helpless look upon Deadsmell, who shrugged and then said,
This whole thing's a waste of time anyway. Every seer and diviner in the whole damned world's got scrambled brains right now.
He gingerly touched his own neck.
I swear I felt that sword's bite. What was Hood thinking? It's insane, the whole thing. Never mind, Hood,
snapped Widdershins.
Wasn't him made me wet my trousers?
Balm stared with huge eyes.
Did you really? Gods below!
Throat Slitter burst out a sudden piping laugh, then ducked.
Sorry, just... Well, never mind.
Widdershin spat on the ground.
None of this is funny, Throat Slitter. You don't get it. That thing, it didn't show up on the other side of the world. It showed up here.
Balm started, looked round.
Where? Get me my armor. Who? What?
Relax, Sergeant, Deadsmell said.
He didn't mean here as in right here. He meant it as... Wid, what did you mean exactly?
What's with the jokes? You're as bad as throat slitter. I don't know why I'm talking to any of you.
We wanted a divination,
said Throat Slitter.
I'm changing my mind. It was a stupid idea. You think Fid's playing with the deck right now? Not a chance. Forget it, I'm going to bed. Not that I'll get any sleep. In fact...
Balm stepped up and punched Widdershins. The man fell in a heap. Throat Slitter yelped again.
Sergeant, what did you do that for?
Frowning, Balm rubbed at his knuckles.
He said he wasn't going to get any sleep. He's asleep now. You two, drag him to his tent. It's time to take charge of things, and that's what I'm doing. Once you get him tucked in, why, we can go find Ebron. We'll get a divination tonight if it kills us.